that's how we.
Well, thanks, Boris. Thanks for twisting my arm. And I realize it's not an easy task to do a talk on introduction to bioinformatics for several reasons. One reason is that bioinformatics is a pretty broad field and still somewhat undefined field, like in terms of what's the subject of study, what's the boundary of the field. It's still not clear. And second reason is that I really have no idea what the audience will be. Like, given that we are here at ITP Institute, so many people here probably know a bit more bioinformatics than I do. And then maybe there are some physicists or some other long-term visitors who don't have much of a background in bioinformatics. So so we'll see. So it's kind of challenging. So the bioinformatics, so instead of trying to do an exhaustive survey of what's available in terms of database and tools in bioinformatics, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to organize a few topics around what I perceived as a core subject of bioinformatics. So this is basically organized around this map. So I guess if one of you here loves this genetic flow diagram here, and how information gets flowed from the genetic information stored on DNA, like in the coding region, in the genes, for example, and gene gets transcribed first to messenger RNA, and which in turn gets translated into protein sequences, and then proteins fold into specific shapes in the cell and perform specific functions. So in my biased view, or very finite sampling of bioinformatics tools and database, what I see is that the bioinformatics core material is basically centered around this diagram, understanding how the genetic information is processed. For example, in the past, a major effort in bioinformatics is trying to figure out where genes are, right? especially when genome projects come on. Lots of new genomes are sequenced, so one major task is trying to figure out where these genes are in the genome. So that's like first part of this diagram here. And so once you figure out a gene, to translate that into protein sequence is no problem because we know genetic code. So that part is basically solved. And then once you have the protein sequences, you want to understand what these proteins do, like or infer the functions of proteins. And that has been also one major effort in the bioinformatics in the last couple of decades, where people try to build databases of protein sequence and structures, and there are search tools, sequence alignment tools for you to find homologous sequences in the database and infer functions. So there are lots of effort on that. That I consider that as one part of the core bioinformatics effort. And pretty recently, do I have a pointer I can use? Is this a pointer? So quite recently, I think a big effort has been trying to understand gene regulation based on sequence information and lots of large-scale gene expression data. And that's getting more and more popular. That's another major effort in bioinformatics. So the basic strategies I will see, this is my perception. You do, first of all, you mimic what cell does, right? You try to, for example, find the genes. Cell has a polymerism machine, they recognize promoters, they go to the promoter, transcribe genes. So one strategy is to try to mimic what cell does, try to recognize these sequence signals that cell machine recognize, and use that as a predictive tool. That's one effort. And another, of course, since we are not just a cell, we know a lot better than cell knows. Like we can use statistics that cell cannot use. For one obvious example is that you can do comparative genomics, which cell has no idea. I mean, a single cell doesn't know what other cells has. So the there's a huge amount of information available now. They can be basically just roughly divided into different categories. One is that there are primary sequence information. There's huge amount of DNA sequences, so with mostly centralized in this gene bank. And then there's a huge number of protein sequences and also the structure itself, crystal structure itself. So two primary databases, SwissPro and PDB, protein structure data bank. And then there are lots of genome databases built for various organisms. We have that. People have systematic build database for each organism that they are interested in, like E. coli, yeast, C. elegans fly, human, mouse, with lots of information collected, not just sequence, but also lots of annotation data, functional study, various data collected in these databases. And then there are some lots of other more specialized or data banks or the databases derived from the primary databases, such as the protein family databases, protein domains, and people also try to do structure classification for different protein structures. So a few databases such as the PFARM and BLOCKS are examples of protein family database, where you actually put different families, classify protein sequences into different families, and you can use that as a search tool to search for putative members of family. And then there are also these promoter databases that, like UKR promoter database, that archive experimentally determine the promoters, like for genes. And transcription factor binding sites database, one famous database is TransFact database, that collect lots of experimental alone binding sites of transcription factors. And
yeah. In practice, if you have an open reading frame, what do you do? You just use some version of BLAST on CGI?
Yeah, that's probably the first thing you want to do with you.
And that is sufficiently clever that it will use these domain databases?
No, I don't think so. If you end to NCBI BLAST, it will pull out the homologous sequences. But it does not,
but it also breaks
to my knowledge,
domains.
It breaks up into pieces for lined pieces. I don't know, I haven't used that in detail.
So how would you
I don't think it's automatically linked to these various domain databases. I mean,
so is there something better? So how would you...
You want something linked to everything?
No.
Oh, if you want to use...
I may want it, but I'm not about to
If you want to use this, you can submit your sequence to these databases. They do search for you. They have these models for different protein families, and they do search for you. Right? Is NCBI linked to... Anyone know if NCBI is linked to this?
So
database?
You would you'll basically...
You do them by yourself.
Take your sequence...
And
go to
one of these databases.
Site, paste it in, and do research there.
That's how I do it if I want to.
And then CGI, you know what they call comparable domain database.
Right, but when you do BLAST search, can you see, tell me what protein domain it matches?
It certainly spits out something showing domains. And
okay.
The question is, where it gets it, whether the information you'll get there is consistent with those other things. It is utilizing a better domain database or a worse one, then we get a different answer if you do it on a different database.
Yeah, I don't know how they are linked. Okay, then there are, especially boosted by recent genome projects, there are lots of large-scale experimental data came out, like the DNA micro data, the gene expression data from DNA microarray. And there are several places that try to basically put this microarray data into databases and there are also efforts trying to standardize the, make the protocol and the storage and format standard. But it's still pretty in a pretty messy state now. And Stanford has a library database called SMD. They collect a whole bunch of DNA micro experiments. And there are also large scale functional assay. For example, people try to go to use various genome and do systematic gene deletion or label gene deletion experiment, look at what phenotypes this deletion cause, or tag every protein in the genome and see the cellular location of these of the proteins are. And there are also systematic data on protein-protein interaction. For example, in yeast, people try to do a genome-wide two-hybrid experiment to see which protein interact with which. Currently, the two-hybrid data is still pretty noisy. I haven't analyzed two-hybrid data carefully, but Kim told me that there are lots of noise in the two-hybrid data. But David Eisenberg at UCLA actually tried to build a database for interacting proteins, and he has a pretty nice database where you can search for potential interaction partners for any protein you're interested in. And then recently, there are also transcription factor location data. For example, Ricky Young at MIT recently just did about 100 or so transcription factors where they basically express the transcription factor with the antibody tag. For about 100 or so transcription factors, they do it one by one. They link the transcription factor to DNA and plot the DNA with antibody, fragment DNA, and just put DNA on the microarray to see which intergenic probe it actually lights up. So there are data like this. Like from our analysis, we see that maybe about a third of the data has good quality, where you pull out the non-targets of transcription factors. But this is just, I say it's just the beginning of the huge effort trying to figure out where the transcription factor binds to in the genome.
So is that available?
They actually put the data online. Basically, they give you, for each intergenic probe, the ratio of fluorescence for the one that pulled up by antibody and just background DNA. Mm-hmm. So the in the past, I'm not going to talk a lot about gene finding. First of all, because I'm not an expert on gene finding, I only know a little bit about gene finding. So in the past, that a lot of effort in bioinformatics has devoted to gene finding, which is to figure out the where genes are on the DNA. And so if you look, if you amplify or zoom in, that region of a gene actually has a much more complicated structure. For example, the polymerase bind to the promoter region, it starts transcription. So genes are in eukaryotic genome, especially in higher eukaryotes, genes are typically broken into pieces of coding region and the intron regions. So I guess most people know exons and introns. So when this gene gets transcribed, the whole thing is transcribed. That's the RNA before the processing. And then there are splicing machines going on, cut out, splice out these introns to make a matured RNA. So if you look at the DNA piece here, typically has lots of singulose. When singulose for transcription starts, there are singulose for splicing sites, and also there are singulose for the transcription terminations. And in addition to that, because we know the exons code for amino acids, so the exon region has a very different codon usage, if you like or triplet usage, if you are in the right frame, right? So if it's a right frame, every triplet code for amino acid, and every species has its own preference for what triplet to use for coding different amino acid. So you'll see a difference in codon usage, but if you shift the frame, then that's pretty much get randomized. So the major singular for these coding regions are actually, in fact, this codon usage. Or people even go longer to like dicodon, so you look at hexamer frequency in these regions. And plus, this singular for transcription start, a splicing side, you can build a fairly complicated model for recognizing genes.
So, what are we at recognizing splicing sites?
Splicing site, I don't know the accurate number for that. I think it's pretty good.
But there's some sharp.
It's pretty splice. Pretty conserved. Oh. The splicing, yeah. No, it's longer than that. It's longer than that. You look at the recent paper by Chris Burge, and they look at splicing site and splicing enhancers. The splicing junction site is actually pretty conserved with high information content. So as I said, the type of singular is a combination of promoter sequencing sequence splicing site, and I think the most contributing, the strongest contributing factor is actually this Hexmer frequency. If you look at them in the window in the exon region and compare that, the intron region is basically randomized, right? So that's a big signal. And also people also try to use homology to known.
So did you say Hexmer?
Like you look at the frequency of six nucleotide together, right? Like two triplets together. There are certain dicodon correlation. But to the first approximation, I think the triplet frequency already gave you a big discrimination for coding non-coding region. And typically these singulars are like species specific. So for different recognition genes in different species, you need different training sets. There are lots of gene finding algorithms developed. One well-known gene finding algorithm is a gene scan developed by Chris Burge. And according, this is a quote from their paper that their accuracy of recognition, like coding regions, 90% in terms of single base, and about 80% correct exon. That refers to a correct exon means that you have to accurately identifying the two boundary. So that's pretty good.
How is this accuracy different between prokaryotes and eukaryotes? Is it easier to search for prokaryotes?
I think prokaryotes is easier. It's not simpler because there's no intron. Most of prokaryotes, there's no intron. Like one simple search algorithm can be just search for continuous stretch of DNA with no stop codon, right? For longest piece of DNA region with no stop, which is not interrupted by stop codon.
From what you can just said, intron can also be useful signal, right?
So what?
From what you can just said, intron can also be a useful signal, so perhaps it can help in making things.
No, but with intron, you need to accurately determine the boundary, right? Intron exon boundary. But if there's no intron, then it's just continuous stretch of coding region. And I think the first time when people search for open reading frame in yeast, they actually use this very simple algorithm. They just say, let's find a piece of DNA that is very long and not interrupted by a stop codon. Because typically you expect to see if you are not at the right frame or you're in non-coding region, once every 20 triplet, you expect to see one stop codon, right? But if you see something like you see 100 triplet with no stop codon, then it's very likely to be a coding region.
Mm-hmm. Some people, somehow, what is the quickest way of seeing this triplet codon signal? In some people use Fourier transforms and say, is that guy's crazy way?
I don't know, the quickest way, we try the one quickest way, which is you just pick a window and you chop into triplet. And you just compute the entropy, right, of the triplet, and you move the frame, and you see entropy has a periodic behavior. It drops when you're at the right coding frame, reading frame. If it's not at right coding frame, then it's randomized, right? The entropy is larger. So you see characteristic three period of drop of entropy, and that gives you a very clear signal.
What?
You can try different window size, yeah.
But for the same window size, you move one triplet.
Oh, because once you are out of frame, then the triplet frequency is randomized, right? Because you try to, suppose you are at the right reading frame, then all these triplets code for amino acids, and there are certain bias on which triplet to use. But once you shift one frame, you kind of piece together two bases from previous codon and one base from this codon, you basically randomize it. And we'll try some other things, like we have our Moby Dick algorithm, we use it to do segmentation in the region, and you also see characteristic segmentation of three in the coding region. So that would be very simple gene finding algorithm. But people do much, I mean, you can use a lot more information to refine. So as I said, find gene is one big thing. And then if you find the gene, then get the protein sequence is not a problem because of genetic code. And one big effort in bioinformatics is really to infer the function of proteins, right? Suppose, and this is used a lot by biologists, especially when you do some genetic screening, you find the gene, you clone the gene, and you identify its sequence. So, and you want to know what does the protein do? So what can you see about the protein? And typically you know what does it do genetically, right? Because you screen that, you find it by genetic screening, but you don't know what does it do biochemically, so in terms of mechanism. So you want to know what does it do, so what's its biochemical function, and how does it do it, right, in terms of mechanism. And if you want to go further, you want to fiddle with, you want to change, you want to synthesize a new protein or mutate certain base and make it something else, or make it a better enzyme. So that's typically in the experiment lab that the kind of question you ask once you clone a gene and you find the protein sequence.
Can you go backwards? Suppose you want a certain protein, you want to design a certain protein.
Right.
And you can go back and ask what is the DNA sequence that would give this.
You want to design a protein?
Yeah. I mean, no. Suppose you want a protein. Is the problem reversible?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of design, if you want, you know a protein sequence you want to design.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy, right? Because you just use genetic code.
Oh, to find out what.
To find out what DNA you design.
And then at the DNA level, can you substitute nucleotides?
You can. I mean, there are lots of amino acids are coded by four different codons.
Oh, okay.
With the third codon position totally variable.
So once you have a protein that you want, you can easily change the DNA to produce the
That's essentially what you do in recombinant medicine. Like,
that's what you do in recombinant
medicine. You simply feed the DNA into production machines in tanks of either yeast or bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make both production.
Yeah, most of the time, people don't design protein in de novo. They start with some template they want to design, and they want to, say, change a few amino acids.
Right.
And you do that by recombinant too. Mm-hmm. And you can also do combinatorial design de novo, right? Dependent, you can design totally new protein with arbitrary amino acid composition.
What is the junk? The junk is the intron, right? Or the exon?
We don't know if it's really junk. An intron certainly is not, eventually is not translated.
Right. So when you go backwards, how do you know what intron is fitting?
What intron to put in? Oh, you say if you really want to make an intron?
Yeah.
You
have to watch out what the sequencing design.
Yeah,
is.
Yeah.
Intron will get chopped. Something will get
right.
There are.
You don't particularly need an intron back.
Right.
Yeah, intron is not translated, but it's important for splicing, for example.
Right, so
if you get rid of intron, you may get rid of splicing signal. That eventually this will not splice correctly.
So maybe I'm not expressing my question correctly. Suppose I want to design a protein and I go back and I say the gene DNA sequence should be like this, but I don't know how to put in some introns, right?
You don't need to put introns.
Right?
You can just put a continuous piece of DNA that's translated into the correct protein. Well, if you want to study how intron works, you may want
so
to try.
So would the splicing machine go around and do this? It knows not to splice, right?
It knows where to splice, yeah. Okay, so predicting function from structure, I think the most successful approach is still by homology. Oh, I'm sorry, predict function or structure from sequence. And the most successful approach is still homology-based. Either a weak either strong homology in the global sense or weak homology in the local sense. So in the introduction to bioinformatics, I think it's impossible not to talk about sequence alignment, because that's probably the most popular tool in bioinformatics and probably the most useful tool, at least in my view. So they find similar, the one approach, of course, once you have a protein sequence, then you have a very large database of protein sequences. Some of them people have studied very carefully, or even some of them people have already solved the structure, X-ray structure. So you, what you want to do, the first is that in any lab, once you find a new protein sequence, what you want to do, you do BLAST, right? Against database to see if you can pull out something that is very similar to the sequence and you know the functional mechanism. Yeah. What? How do you find homology? Oh, so that's basically sequence alignment. So these are the a few sequence alignment tools like BLAST, CyBLAST, which I will talk about. Right? So once you find the homologous sequences similar to the one that you're interested, you can infer a function based on conservation. Right? You see that if the sequence is very similar, maybe it's doing similar thing. So that's the homology-based inference. And sometime you may not be able to, you may find a whole bunch of hits in the database, right? Like several similar sequences, but none of them you know its function. So one thing you can do is that once you find many sequences, you can do a multiple sequence alignment. And this is also relevant to the design problem, like which residue you want to fiddle. You want to change something, you want to change the affinity of protein to DNA, you want to change the enzyme efficiency, et cetera, or stability. You want to target like critical residues. And for that purpose, you can do multiple sequence alignment. So kind of multiple sequence alignment give you more information because you know which residue is conserved, which one is not. And in the case that you may not be able to detect any homology to the database by this general sequence alignment search, you may be able to find something interesting just by the pattern profile search, which is more local. Like you have a small stretch of amino acid, maybe 10 amino acid long, which looks similar, and it forms a functional domain. If you find that piece of stretch of amino acid, you may be able to also infer the function, even though globally the protein sequence is not similar on a larger scale. So this will be the profile of pattern search. You can search for patterns, or small patterns, or narrow window profiles.
You're saying that the first two algorithms will not detect a good match of a subsequence. They won't.
Very small. Yeah, no. If you see in the 5 amino acid, right, with some specific pattern there, they won't be able to tell you.
There's presumably some, depending on the length of the sequence and the length of the motif.
Right.
There is
some, the length of sequence may be too short to be anything because you are. I'm sorry, you're taking the sequence to match against a big, huge database, right? The chance of hitting a few, let's say 5 amino acids that look similar is very big. But if you know there's a specific pattern that is conserved across the family of members, and that's, for example, active site for metal binding, and you see that pattern in your protein, it may indicate your protein also have that feature.
So I understand. You wouldn't want to do it in BLAST, but in this multiple sequence alignment.
Yes.
You get sort of a very strong alignment of a subsequence.
That's what I see. That's what these databases do, right? Like ProCyte build the patterns, and blocks use the contiguous aligned small domains to build the profile.
Yeah.
CyBLAST and BLAST. Okay, I'm going to talk about that. CyBLAST. Let me first get on to BLAST. Okay, sequence alignment. So are the audience all familiar with sequence alignment? No? OK, so I shouldn't assume. So the basic idea is that for sequence alignment, you have two sequences. You want to see if it's similar. So you're trying to align these residuals, or by, for example, you can also insert gaps in the middle and try. This is the example where you can align these residues together by inserting two gaps here. Okay, but for any sequence alignment to assess how good alignment is, first of all, you need a scoring scheme, right? You need to see how do I score this alignment, and to specify the score for this thing, you need, for example, score when every time when you pair when you align a pair of amino acid residue. Like these two are similar, these are two different, you need to know how to score them. And then you need to know how to score these gaps, right, when you have insertions or deletions. So this for scoring the pair matches, there's a substitution matrix, and then there's a gap penalty for insertion and deletions. And typically, I think this is mostly for the ease of programming, people use the affine gap penalty, which means that there's a cost for opening a gap, and then there's a cost for extension of a gap, and it's linear. So the form is A plus B X, where X is the number of gaps. And then you also, so two cases for alignment. One is that you need to know how to score them. This is a scoring scheme. And then you need to know how to compute the statistical significance. And that's a huge field, right? Like computing the statistical significance of alignment.
How do you get, the penalty for a mismatch,
mm-hmm.
and penalty for having an extra point in gap, that's a
pre-parameter, or that gets set by some kind of? Well, it's mostly empirical, right? But the substitution matrix were derived from sets of aligned protein sequences, like families of aligned protein sequences. Like in one case, this POM matrix, which is the early matrix they used for sequence alignment, were actually derived from ungapped alignment of the very close family of proteins. So the idea is that you take this, for example, you can start by, for these highly similar protein sequences, you don't even need to have an alignment algorithm to do it, right? Because there are only a few mismatches when you pair them together, and it's clear, and you want ungapped alignment. So you can even do that by hand to get all these sequences aligned. And then you can just go count the pairs of A matched to B in this alignment and normalize that, right, by the expected frequency. And this is actually log odd score for seeing a pair of A, B aligned against each other in this specific family. But then what Pam matrix, the Dehoff did is actually, he said that now I derive a matrix of scoring matrix, a substitution matrix for this family, but I won't be able to extrapolate to some other family. So basically you write a substitution matrix as an exponential of some rate matrix, transition matrix. And then you extrapolate that by basically power, take it to nth power, right? So that gives you to longer distance. So let me see if I see this correctly. The idea is that suppose you try to align two sequences and you want to do a maximum likelihood calculation. You want to say, now I want to adjust my rate parameter so that I get maximum likelihood for the alignment. And the way you do that, by simple calculation, you can show that the maximum likelihood inference of parameter is basically proportional to the counts, right? So here is basically maximum likelihood inference of the transition parameters, of the substitution parameters, but for that specific protein family, which has certain divergence time.
So you don't just take the power of the matrix, you have to turn it into transition.
You turn into E of Tm, right? So this is a substitution matrix, but it could be there could be multiple substitutions. So
you have to turn it's an asymmetric matrix that you multiply, right? Transition probability matrix that you multiply.
Oh, this one is symmetric, right?
That's right. So you don't want to take the power to multiply those? I'm confused.
Suppose
then correctly.
Suppose this is a transition matrix, a substitution matrix after 10 million years of divergence.
Well,
right.
I thought that the idea was that you derive this for very closely related
right.
Proteins,
right.
And then you assume that there's been only one substitution on site.
There's only one substitution on site.
For example.
Right.
Right. So.
So that gave you a problem.
Incorrectly,
yeah.
We can get sort of transition probability. Right?
Yes,
from
yes,
one
yes.
Amino acid to another, and now we can extrapolate that as far as we want.
Yeah, the transition. So the transition rate is actually log of this substitution matrix, right? If you see that I model the substitution process as the Markov chain, which is the multiplication of infinitesimal transition matrices, then you basically get exponential expression. And that matrix and the exponent.
I have elementary confusion here. This thing is symmetric.
Yeah, this thing is the
transition matrix is not symmetric.
Well, is this symmetric?
Transition matrix
well,
is
well,
symmetric.
By definition.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. Okay.
The alignment, I don't think that there is a dominant amino acid in a particular column. The alignment.
Well, PAB, so
the
frequency of the line.
This is all symmetrized. This is already symmetrized. What there's the there's a complication here. Actually, you can have the reason that the rate transition matrix is asymmetric, but this is symmetric. Substitution matrix is symmetric. Is that you can have one ancestor, imagine one ancestor diverging to two descendants, right? You can have transition happen on one strand or on another strand. Even though the rate is not symmetric, the observed substitution matrix is still symmetric.
No, that, of course.
Yeah, if the
substitution matrix is symmetric, but if you want to extrapolate.
Yeah. So you need to infer also ancestor sequence. That's the point, right? Because this is symmetric. You need to infer which is the ancestor sequence, which is low, because you have this block of alignment.
Yeah.
Then you can get a symmetric transition, right? Okay, we can discuss this later because I don't want to hang on here. This is also not my specialty. Right? So the idea is that you actually extrapolate. There are a whole bunch of PAM matrices that actually correspond to different evolutionary distance.
But but one doesn't know what distance to use. So in practice, so presumably as x goes to infinity,
right.
That thing should just factorize, right?
Right, so you don't know distance to use. That's why it's empirical. So when I ask you, if people ask you, which PAM matrix are you going to use for your sequence alignment? You see, typically I don't know, but people try the various matrices to find which one works the best. Right, it's similar to Blossom matrix. There are a whole bunch of Blossom matrix, and if you go to Blossom website, you'll see recommend the standard Blossom 62. And why is that? I mean, it's empirical. Yeah.
After all, that is definitely a stupid question. Okay, which is that how do you operationally do that? You align them up, and
mm-hmm.
then you say what you take up from that set appear at the time. And decide what is PAB?
You look at every pair of sequences and you count number of times the AB are paired together.
Right, but when I have a particular, say, column there.
Yeah, you have a column.
Right,
but
in that column. Okay.
So when you count this, you actually count every pairwise. You don't look at the column.
What I'm trying to say is that this asymmetric question may actually be resolved, if you think, okay, carefully how it is done. So if I look at a particular column, I can see dominant is reducing, but once in a
right.
while I saw something else.
Right.
I could say, I take that distribution,
mm-hmm.
not every possible pair in the world,
mm-hmm.
and then I can try to estimate transition rates
right.
by saying most of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is in the definition of PAB. If you define PAB that way, it doesn't matter.
Right. So that's that way you can directly extract the transition
yes.
probability as well.
Right. But if you have combined up everything, that right.
Right, but that
right, all columns, then you
don't I claim you still get a similar amount of information because when you look at pairwise, you lose that information, right, of the asymmetry, etc. So you can't, basically you can't assume the transition can happen on either strand, therefore it becomes symmetric.
Imagine there was one column which is mostly leucine and a few isolucine.
Yeah, I agree. This is
another column which is mostly isolucine, few leucine, and you saw huge statistical difference between them.
You certainly can get the transition matrix the way you describe, but I think it's not what Dehov did at the beginning. Yeah. I don't want to hang on with this matrix forever. So, as I said, there are various choice of matrices and say gap penalties, etc. And if you go to BLAST website, they actually recommend you that for different lengths of protein that you use different matrices and gap penalties. And I think these are mostly just empirical. There's no theory. Maybe I'm wrong. But the one typical behavior of the
query length.
Oh, query length means that the sequence you submit to search. Now, if it's short, the basic idea is that if it's short, you want to use a more restricted matrix. You want to compare that to a very close family, mm-hmm. and because you don't want to have lots of false matches there. So there are various alignment algorithms that there's a global alignment algorithm called Lindemann-Walsh that basically try to align two sequences from end to end, and that's occasionally this is still useful, but most of the people are, like for sequence homology search, people are no longer using this.
But it's from end to end, meaning that there are no gaps at the end?
No, you can have gaps at the end. You can. But so you can match a gap at the end, but you. So this algorithm searches for the optimal alignment regarding to all possible pairing, including gaps at the end. And then there's a Smith-Waterman algorithm which looks for local piece of optimal alignment. And BLAST is just, I think it's just approximation to Smith-Waterman.
So what is the difference between global alignment and local alignment? Two local pieces, I just don't understand.
Oh, so just think about the gapless case, right? In the global alignment case, you have to slide this sequence around to see which one gave you highest score.
Yes.
In the local alignment case, I only need to focus on a small piece. I don't need to add the scores in the flanking region. That's the difference. Right, so you align these two sequences. So this is global. This is one, and this is local. You just look
and
for a small piece of those.
Waterman just picks
Smith-Waterman find any small local pieces that have given you highest score.
I see. And then completely discards things that.
Oh, you forget about this stuff on the flanking region, right? Yeah. Oh, you can also have gap. You still can have gap.
The number of gaps is not restricted. I'm completely confused. So in the first one, you allow any number of gaps.
Forget about a gap law. Just see, I want to do gapless alignment. So what's the difference between global and local?
Well, I think if it's gapless, it's unambiguous.
It's unambiguous.
Yeah.
And with gap.
And with gap.
With gap, why it's ambiguous? Suppose now in Smith-Waterman, I decide to just cut a piece in the middle of the sequence and do a gapped alignment with this big sequence. I still can't get a good score.
But now the question is which piece you cut and how many pieces
you cut and you cut the various ways you actually can cut every way you want.
But every time we start putting in gaps, we are cutting into pieces.
But then in the global alignment you have to add scores from the pieces separated by gaps. No, in this
and also cost of gaps, right?
And the cost of gaps, right?
So now what we're
But now is that suppose in the global alignment you have one piece like this and big gap like this.
Yes.
So you add this piece, you add the gap cost, you add this piece.
Right.
Now if I found that by just get rid of this whole thing here, I can get a perfect alignment here.
Yes.
I don't need to care about all these gap cuts and mismatches.
Okay, so we're basically disposing.
Yeah, you're disposing pieces of.
With all the gap costs and all the stuff that
yeah,
was on
yeah,
the previous slide.
Yeah, yeah. No. No, you cut it. You cut.
You
still can't. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not
saying the local alignment, you don't have a gap, but you're not obligated to take everything. That's right.
Local alignment,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's you can actually cut a small piece from the sequence and do alignment.
I'm missing something.
So if someone gives you a whole protein, global alignment should mean local alignment is you pick
domains.
So
there is a question how you compare this thing.
Where
right? And
the
point is that
there's a notion.
I find one matching in an asset and
no,
then it's not significant, Boris. Boris, if you have one. Well, if you have one amino acid, it's not significant. And also, the score is probably not highest because you may find a stretch of six amino acids that matches exactly with the database sequence. Then it's better than just one amino acid.
Okay.
But it's also better than taking 50 amino acids together because then you have to add the gap cost and mismatches for the rest of 44. Is that clear?
Yes. Okay, so now I think I'm...
Okay. And BLAST is just a very popular and fast algorithm that heuristically implements Smith Waterman. So it's like BLAST try to first find the nucleus of short stretch of amino acids that matches very well, and then extend from that nucleus to the two sides. Well, I don't think I'm going to talk about this. Some of these slides I gave when I gave introductory courses to biology students at UCSF. So they want to know like what do you use, right? Like when you do BLAST, you can submit a protein sequence, you can submit a nucleotide sequence, and there are various versions of BLAST. You can choose that align your, for example, if you have nucleotide sequence, you try to translate your nucleotide sequence into protein and then match against the query. There are various versions. Unless you actually use it, you don't know that. And then the choice of parameters that, I mean, in general, this matrix is recommended as a standard matrix for doing for the substitution score. And the effect of these gap penalties, as you can see easily, that if you have a very large open gap open penalty, very large extension penalty, you are going to see very few insertion and deletions. Right? And if you have a small gap extension, then you are going to see large insertions, but a few. So you can tone these parameters depending on what your perception about the alignment is, especially when you like try to align DNA sequences, like non-coding DNA sequences, where you expect to see a number of large insertions and gaps. You may want to tone the gap penalty to a small extension penalty, etc. And the significance, and typically that the recommendation is that if you see a E value smaller than 10 to the minus 3, and you see a piece of DNA aligned, like you can get alignment of more than 80 amino acids or so with sequence identity larger than 30%, then you believe it's a significant hit. Well, the CyBLAST, the difference between BLAST and CyBLAST is when you use BLAST, actually, you first use BLAST. When you submit a sequence, you first use BLAST, and BLAST will return a number of significant hits to you. So these are the homologous sequence. But then you can go on to the next cycle, use CyBLAST by iteration. The idea is that once you pull out, say, 10 members of the homologous sequence in the family, then you get a pretty good idea at each position what is most likely to occur, right? Just as you say, if you align 10 amino acid sequences together and you see 10, all of 10 are isoleucine at position 1, then you see the other members are more likely to be isoleucine at this position. So you kind of, once you have the alignment from first round, you can build a position-specific scoring scheme to search for other database sequences. So that's how.
And it's technically done again, like
Yeah, it's kind of profile-like.
And then you don't just look for more, you also do something self-consistent.
You do re-evaluate everything.
Okay, so
yeah. You and you also, you do pull out more. So, what? Okay, so only for people interested in using it. The point is that Cyblast is more sensitive, right? So you may miss some members of family in the first round, but once you build that position-specific profile, it's more sensitive to that specific family. You may be able to pull out some other members from family in the second and third round. What? Second round, what?
You have to get enough statistics to make a scoring metric at reasonable.
Yeah, the first round, but yeah, if you only hit one, still you have two is better than one, right? If you hit one, you see several position conserved, that still give you a bias towards these residues in the second round of search. So as long as you hit something in the first round, that will help you in the second round or third round. Okay, another thing is that once you have like multiple sequences, you can try to do multiple sequence alignment. And in the way that nature already has performed the mutagenesis for us, that nature tells you which residue is important, which can be changed, which cannot be changed. So for example, here is an example where you see that highly conserved residues of A and P and GH. So for multiple sequence alignment, one canonical algorithm now is called Cas2W. I think most people, this is a pretty fast algorithm, it's not necessarily best. Lots of people are still working on multiple sequence alignment. It's a hard, very hard problem. And for a small number of sequences, actually you can try to generalize the dynamic programming that people use for two sequence alignment. And the limit is basically you cannot go beyond more than 8 sequences. Below 8 sequences, you may be able to, with faster computer, you still can rigorously solve this problem by doing dynamic programming, but above 8 sequences the running time is exponential in number of sequences, and you basically cannot extend that to much larger sequences. So the Cas2W is a heuristic algorithm for doing multiple sequence alignment. Basically, what it tries to do is that first it tries to do pairwise alignment. Take all pairs from the group and calculate alignment scores and et cetera. So you build a distance matrix. And then you, based on that matrix, you can do make a dendrogram. So you make a cluster diagram for the sequence. For example, if sequence 1 and 2 are very similar, you join them together, you align them. Right? And then next time you align sequence 3 and 4, and once you have the alignment, you no longer move them relative to each other. So in the way you fix it already. And next time you align the two groups together and you align them as a whole group. So that's why it's heuristic, right? So it's kind of stuck. Once you find the two highly similar sequences, you align them, their relative relationship is kind of stuck. So that's how this Cas2W thing works. So you do progressive alignment following the guide tree. And I'm not going to give you an example, I think I'm going to skip it. And this is a popular program for doing multiple sequence alignment as well as for build a phylogenetic tree. People also use this Cas2W algorithm to build a phylogenetic tree. Okay, so sometimes your sequence may not have a high homology when you do BLAST or BLAST type of search to database, but it may have some interesting features that can be picked up not from the sequence alignment but from the patterns or the local profiles. So in the past, lots of bioinformatics has devoted to building protein families and profiles in the effort trying to see what are the features of this family that you can use to detect putative members of family. So people build various databases. So these are just a few from the maybe more than 1,000 or so protein family profile databases. One is called ProCyte, This database contains lots of local motifs, like functional, biochemically functional motifs that people derive. At the early stage when they derive this database, they actually do lots of hand curation. And then blocks database are derived from lots of alignment of protein families, like ungapped region of alignment from multiple protein families. And then PFARM is a kind of generalization of block where you can have blocks connected to each other characterized by head and Markov model. So for the process, this is literally how they did it at the beginning when they tried to see let's characterize metal binding site or enzyme active site or reaction site, etc. So that's literally how they did it. And so this is one example. This is the active site. I forgot whichever it is. So you just basically align the sequences together and you find that, oh, there's a common pattern which can be characterized by this very short strand, ATHDOE. So Boas says you can see that if you see this pattern in your sequence, it may indicate that it has a similar active site, but there's no way you can find this kind of pattern by the blast search, right? It's just too short. The blocks actually build a profile based on multiple sequence alignment. So one simple way to build this profile is that suppose you find at position X, the frequency of base B at position X. So this is what you have. When you build the profile, say for DNA sequence, this position frequency is actually what you use. But for protein, because we know that there are similarities between amino acids, so having C, B at that position, if A and B are highly similar, as characterized by high score, substitution score between A and B. So for example, leucine and isoleucine are very similar. They have a high similarity score. So having C, leucine at this position indicates that it's also likely to see isoleucine. So one simple scheme people use to build this profile is actually the weight, this count at position X by the scoring matrix. So that's how you construct the profile at X. And I'll give you one example here. So for example, this is one example where you have the alignment here. And you want to build a profile, see at position one, what's the probability or the score for base A at position one? And you see, since I see 3 times V, that counts for 5/3. And the scoring, the corresponding scoring matrix for having the V and to see base A, etc. So you basically have a weighted average of scores for different bases at this position. That's one very simple way to build a profile. So this is one example where the profile built from block. This is called histidine triad motif, where you see that these are the profile values for different bases at different positions, and you see 3 very strong histidine at these 3 positions. So there are various databases like this where you can submit your sequence and search for profiles or domains. And I'm not aware, I mean, I haven't used the BLAST a lot, so I don't know how these databases actually connect to various profile databases.
So what you just described is these blocks.
Yeah, it's one of the block profile, yeah. Okay, finally, I just want to quickly mention that there are other ways for predicting structures based on sequence. For example, people can predict transmembrane helices with pretty high accuracy. And the basic idea is that it's simply just transmembrane helices that have high hydrophobicity in the transmembrane region. So if you just look for stretches of sequence that has high hydrophobicity, you can basically locate where the transmembrane helices are. And there are lots of secondary structure prediction algorithms, right? And many of them works with this kind of accuracy. Yeah. Have a transmembrane helices?
Yeah.
I don't know the number. but I will see the majority of them. So the second structure prediction is kind of mature, but hit the ceiling of like 75%. That's the accuracy you can do. And for the tertiary structure prediction, the most reliable way is still homology modeling, right? So where you have a sequence, you search database, you pull out another sequence, and that sequence happens to have a structure in PDB. Then you can model your new structure, the structure of your protein, based on that structure of the sequence of with high homology to your sequence. And people are still working very hard on ab initio structure prediction. So every year there's a CASP competition for predicting protein structures, given that you only know the sequences. And these sequences are the sequences found out in biological labs and who is actually doing structure determination at the time they give the sequence. So at the end of, at the day when this competition, like eventually people come to a meeting and evaluate who is doing best, at that time the structure is already available. So that's like very bland taste of how good every structure prediction algorithm are. And currently the best algorithm is still David Baker's algorithm, like de novo prediction of protein structures. Secondary structure prediction, for people interested in using them, there are lots of websites that actually allow you to do secondary structure prediction if you just submit your sequence. Okay, now I'm going to move on and focus on this part of this diagram. This is about gene regulation. And this is boosted mostly recently, in the last maybe 5 years or so, 6 years or so, because of genome sequences and large-scale gene expression data come out. So as we know, genes can be regulated at different steps of the gene expression. It can be regulated at the transcriptional level, where you control how many mRNA to synthesize. It can also be regulated at translational level. So many proteins are known to be regulated translationally. Although the mRNA level doesn't change much, but under different conditions, different amount of proteins translated. And lots of proteins are also regulated post-translationally. For example, by phosphorylated protein changes conformation, you can activate or deactivate the protein. But one major control in the gene expression step is actually transcriptional control, where you control the amount of mRNA that's synthesized. And transcriptional control is actually achieved by a whole bunch of proteins called transcription factors in the cell. These are gene-specific transcription factors. They recognize specific DNA signals in the, say, in the promoter region or the regulatory region of the gene. They bind to this DNA, they interact somewhat with the transcription machine to change the speed of transcription. So in principle, the signal is encoded in DNA sequence. And the advance of the technology actually pushes this field. One reason is that people now can do systematic study of gene expression, like Mayer mRNA level in the cell for every gene in the genome by using this DNA chip. And you're going to hear a lot more next week in the bioinformatics workshop. Actually, one of the spot array inventor, Joe DeRisi, is coming next Monday. So this is one of early array data from Joe DeRisi and Pat Brown's lab. So basically, you can label two different samples with two different fluorescence, and you hybridize with a chip that has a probe for the gene, and you can see fluorescence from two channels, and you can see the ratio of the two. So this is one example where you do a lot of different experiments under various conditions, and you see genes go up and down. So red means go up, green means it's down. So this axis is a gene, and this is experimental condition. You can see how the whole genome responds to transcriptionally to different conditions. So the good thing about study transcription regulation is that we have a genome sequence, and we have lots of array data, gene expression data, so you can try to see how you can correlate the sequence signal with the gene expression data. So to look at transcription factor binding site in the genome, there are, generally I would say there are two different approaches. One is knowledge-based, where you know the binding site of some transcription factor, you want to go to the genome, you can search for the sites that are similar to the profile that you already know. And another is that you can try to discover new regulatory sites by pattern recognition, or either combination of pattern recognition combined with the gene expression data analysis. So as I mentioned before, that there are various databases that archive the different binding sites for transcription factors. For example, this is a TransFact database. These are the numbers pretty much a few months ago. What kind of data they have there. And people have also built for different species that they collect different binding sites that figure out experimentally and put it in the database. So here is that how you can, for example, you can use the knowledge of a binding site of some factors that characterize very well and use that as a search tool. So the idea is that, for example, if you look at the 12 different examples for the binding site of this factor called MCB, and you can align this site together, and then you can count the number of bases at different positions. So this is similar to the position profile for the protein families, but protein family is more complicated than this. So you can see that at different positions, you see different counts. For example, this position are purely highly conserved. It's always C, G, and C. And this position can be A, O, T, etc. So this is called alignment. I call it alignment matrix. And you can convert that into a probability matrix by saying that 84% of the time you see A at position 1, and 100% of the time you see C at position 2, etc. So that converts to a frequency matrix. And if you make the assumption that different bases are not correlated, then you have a model. Right? You have a model for the composition of the sites, because that tells you, given this matrix, you can compute the probability of any specific sequence occurring at the site. So this is the position-specific probability matrix. And then under that, you also have the a measure of background. Right? If you go to whole genome, you can count the occurrence, probability occurrence of various bases in the genome. And you can actually use that information to make predictions. This is a matrix called the position-specific weight matrix, which is basically, as you can see from here, it's basically a log odd probability. So this tells you that at position I, what's the log ratio of probability of observing the base sigma in the motif compared to observing the same base in the background, random background sequence. So this is actually log odd scope, and people call it the position weight matrix. And you can use this position weight matrix to score any site in the genome by just add the score together. This is log ratio, so the probability is just multiply. And you add the score together.
Zero.
What?
Zero.
Oh, I basically skipped the part that you actually, when the number counts is very small, you need to add certain pseudo counts into it. So zero means that doesn't mean it cannot occur, it just means the data is too small. The most quantitative useful experiment? Well, one experiment is that if you do a Celex experiment, you have a purified protein, you have a mixture of random pool of oligos, and you just use the protein to pull the oligos and look at the relative amount of different oligos. Boris, what do you see? What's the most useful data? Or if you get 50 different binding sites in vivo, right? That will be also useful, as long as you have large amount of sampling.
And that
random waste start telling you these are the sequence are known to be biologically useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been often used on a on some kind of parallelized biophysical experiment. That's something that we
Yeah, Boris and Ivan actually have a much more
so far it's like
elaborate theory on selectivity.
And he did with the law.
So the broad standard error 0 or 1.
Well, yeah.
Paper says
it's a binding site.
So Ivan, are you going to talk about this?
I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah. So he's going to talk about this next week.
Yeah. So the charge data site.
Yeah. It's actually very good. Okay. I mean, depend on example. The one example I love that the Ira Hershkovitz lab is doing NDT80 experiment. And they are doing lots of in vitro binding AC by mutating different bases. And they get a profile, which is absolutely agree with the in vivo data. It could depend on transcription factor, but for the many cases that people know actually agrees very well. But one interesting thing is that when they did this in vitro mutation analysis, they only get that core motif. But if you look at in vivo site, actually have much more flanking information there. And it turns out the flanking region information is a competitive binding site for some other factor, which is very interesting. Kind of see repressor at the beginning, and the repressor goes off, and then the new factor comes in. So it's a combination of two sites. But I would say, based on the example I know, I mean, it agrees very well with the in vivo data, agrees very well with the in vitro. Okay, so with this matrix, you can actually search the genome. So you get big bump, for example, from the background, and hopefully you have some two sites in the genome that give you a small bump somewhere here, and then you can cut it off and see what I believe as true singular. So this is traditionally how people does it, but Boris and Ivan has some better way of doing this, right? So you're going to talk about. Okay, so I want to just show one example where you can take the promoter of one gene and go to a database like TransFact, ask TransFact to return the result of search based on many, many different weight matrices in the database, and they actually have a tool to do that, but the false positive rate is pretty high. And it depends on which one you believe, which one you don't believe. But anyway, it gives you some prediction, right? So in the example I showed here, for HIS4 actually works very well. If you go to TransFact, you see, let's search for yeast matrices and give me prediction for the binding site. Medisite actually agrees with the experimental figure the site mapped out experimentally. But I don't know if that's general. I mean, I believe the false positive rate is pretty high in general. Okay, so another way is that suppose you don't know the binding site, you can try to identify this site de novo without using the information in the database. So one way to do that, which has been kind of canonical in the past few years, is that you first figure out a group of genes that co-regulated. Namely, for example, in the gene expression data analysis, you see in a specific gene expression experiment, you see this group of genes go up and down together. And you group them, and then you extract the putative regulated regions of these genes, and then you can search for common sequence patterns in the group. And there are various ways you can search for common sequence patterns. Well, I was going to talk a little bit about clustering. How you get groups of co-regulated genes from gene expression data. And I think we have, in the long-term participants, we have many people working on different ways of doing clustering. But the one canonical way of doing clustering is the clustering algorithm developed by Mike Eisen. So they were not developed, the clustering algorithm exists long time ago. Mike Eisen basically imported that into displaying gene expression data. So that's a hierarchical clustering. The idea is that you can, for example, for two genes and you have a whole bunch of expression measurement, you can calculate the distance between two genes, for example, by this Pearson correlation. So that gave you a distance measure. And you can try some other measures of distance too, but in general, I think people believe the Pearson correlation is probably the best measure for distance. And then based on pairwise distance, you can assemble genes into a dendrogram by also progressively assemble different genes according to how similar they are into this whole dendrogram. Eisen had this good contribution to the community by having this interesting display that biologists can look at and easily interpret the result.
So you use the biology to assign
colors? What? No, these colors represent the, so this axis is the gene, right? And this axis is probably different experiment, different time points. And then you basically order these genes based on how close they are. Oh, I see. So in fact, if you look in the algorithm, you actually can also show together with this diagram, also show the functional annotation for the gene. And you look at a group of cluster, and you look at functional annotation, then that's where expert knowledge comes in. You say, oh yeah, I know why this group of genes come together, right? Because I know some biochemical pathways that they are linked, or they are doing some similar thing. What use the opposite?
In the Eisen case, they don't actually use the Pearson correlation.
They did not use Pearson correlation?
No, they
said
an opposite value zero.
What? Opposite value zero, I don't understand this. They try different layer. If you look at their algorithm now, they allow you to choose different distance layer, right? Like Euclidean distance or Pearson correlation, opposite zero or not opposite zero. You can choose various parameters in that clustering algorithm. But so once you have these clusters, you can try to look for common sequence patterns in the group. So two different approach that has been popular in the for a while. One is that the frequency count of the very simple algorithm developed by Van Helden, and which is just simply count substrings in the group of genes that co-regulated and compare that to what you expect to see if you look at the whole genome. And another class of algorithms, so this one is enumerative, right? You basically look at every substrain and you compare that. But the shortcoming is that you cannot deal with very fuzzy patterns. And another one is a local multiple sequence alignment based. And there are three different algorithms that on the market. So for this oligo frequency contrast algorithm developed by these people, they basically just count the number for every strain. You just count the number in the data set, and you also count the number in the contrast set. For example, you find the group of genes co-regulated by phosphate starvation, and then you just take this group, you count the substrain, and you count the substrain frequency in the whole genome promoter region, and you ask, is there a substrain in this group that is overrepresented? So that's how this algorithm works. And actually, I have an example where you take the genes responsible for synthesizing methionine. So this is like a case where you can group genes based on their biochemical function. See, let's take genes that are responsible for methionine synthesizing pathway, and you take their promoter regions, and you run this oligo frequency analysis algorithm. They actually have a nice website where you can go there. You can extract promoter sequences, and then after the sequence is returned, you can follow up by saying, I want to do oligo frequency analysis, I want to do consensus, I want to GIP sampler. So they I have found that website is quite useful because they allow you to extract promoter sequences from many different species.
What is it called?
Do I have this show here? Yeah, this is a RAS tool. I think it's developed by Van Helden. Also, Cloud Vedas is also one of them. So it's pretty useful when you want to do something quick, right? And you don't want to write your own algorithm to extract promoter sequences and do oligo frequency analysis or run GIP sampler. It's actually quite useful. So in this case, that we just take about 12 genes that involved in methionine synthesized pathway, go to that website, extract the promoter sequence, and do oligo analysis. And you actually identify correctly this binding site that is known to be a binding site of this complex, CBF1, MET4, MET28, that this complex is regulating methionine synthesized genes. So this is a good example. And another approach is that you can try to do multiple local sequence alignment. And there are three popular algorithms. One is consensus developed by Stonewall and collaborators, and Deep Sampler by Lawrence Liu and some others, and MGME, the MIM algorithm by Bailey and Elkin. Interestingly, MIM turns out to be the most popular among biologists. As far as the biologists I know, I talk to, they all love MIM for some reason. I guess it's just because the MIM has a very good web interface that people can easily use. So this is that in this business, it's not that how good your tools are, but in fact, how easy it can be used. So the idea is that for local alignment algorithm is that you actually make a model for the motif. So suppose these are the motifs in different promoter sequences, but you don't know their position. You don't know where are they. But so imagine that you managed to find the alignment of these motifs. So you align them together. But I'm not saying how you do it. So suppose you did the correct alignment, then you can get this alignment matrix as I mentioned before, right? You get counts for different bases at different positions relative in that motif. And then you can have this position-specific frequency matrix. And then you can measure the how much information this matrix has. For example, here, it's almost always A. Suppose your background frequency is a quarter. So this is that out of four possibilities I specify, it's always A. So that gives you 2 bits of information, right? And similarly, you can compute the information and for some other cases, which is this black and white case. So you calculate the information content of this motif by this formula, the standard information calculation. And essentially, all these alignment-based algorithms tries to find the path or the alignment that optimizes this, optimizes the information content. And you can actually formulate that in a maximum likelihood approach. The idea is that you have a model for the motif, so you know if it's a motif, what's the probability of observing various sequences, and you also have a model for the background, right? So now, suppose you start with some alignment, where you see the motif at sequence 1 is at x1, motif at sequence 2 is at x2, etc. So you already figured the alignment path. Now you can write down the likelihood function for that. Because once you align that, you know that the probability of observing the sequence is a product of background frequency if it's outside the motif, and the motif frequency, this is for motif model, and also multiplied by other background frequency after the motif. Right? So, and you do that for every sequence. So you get a big likelihood function as a function of the alignment path x. So now what you do is that you see, let's fix x and first figure out the frequencies, the assignment for the motif frequencies that optimize this, optimize the likelihood, or maximize the likelihood. And by some simple exercise, you can show that your assignment of frequency is proportional to the counts. So once you specify paths, you count the bases, and that's proportional to the frequency where you maximize the likelihood function. But then you have to also, so this is the formula here. But then you have to say, now I have to vary my x, because I don't know which x is the correct alignment path. So you then optimize this thing by varying the path, alignment path. So this is, of course, that hopelessly slow, hopeless if you want to enumerate all the alignment paths, because it's exponential in number of sequences. But Stonewall and the collaborator figure out the heuristic algorithm to search for alignment that give you optimal, give you maximum of information content. The idea is that they actually start with a pair of subsequences. In the early version of algorithm, they start with two sequences, and they try to do all the sub-sequence alignment between the two. And then they keep the, say, top 1,000 base alignment. So you get top 100 base, top 1,000 base pairwise alignment at the beginning. And then you add the third sequence, and you just align sub-sequence from third to the 1,000 you already have. And then you build alignment for three, right? And you do that progressively. That's the greedy algorithm they developed at the beginning. And now they have a better version, and it runs slower, where you take, at the beginning, you take all the subsequences of a given width and align them against each other. So Stomer will be here next week, but he said he's not going to talk about this because he wants to talk about something new, like protein DNA recognition code. But his algorithm is one example of this local alignment algorithm that basically you can formulate in maximum likelihood formalism. And here is one example where you can take, see, the genes identified to respond, transcription that respond to phosphate starvation or perturbation of the pathway controlled by 4. Right, so you get the, like one experiment done by Ernst Schiess lab at UCSF, they identify about 22 of those. So you take all these genes, you extract this promoter sequence, and then you just run this Stomer's consensus algorithm, and you find the correct site. So this is the site that actually people know this is the binding site for 4-4, for the transcription factor downstream. So this is a case that motif is pretty strong. The consensus managed to find out the motif easily. But there are also other cases like this strong motif, sometimes you find, sometimes you don't. So yeah.
Doesn't understand the limitations of
no. I would say no.
Local alignment?
No. Basically there's no good theory as to what feature of these sites you need in order to be picked up by this algorithm. You just have to try. Or you most of the time that we try different algorithms and compare. Now you can try consensus, we can try our algorithm. We have the Moby Dick I'm not going to talk about. And you can try the oligofrequency analysis. And oligofrequency analysis is not very sensitive, right? Because if it's weak, it doesn't pick it up. But anything pick it up, it's very specific. It really gives you lots of false positives. But many of these local alignment algorithms give you lots of false positives. One big reason is that they just don't have a very good background model, right? Because see the previous version of consensus used a background model that says all the base, the background sequence is single base random. And then if you run the east promoter, you get lots of THTHT motif because they are not random, they are correlated, right? So people are trying to correct this, like the later version of GIP sampler, Jun Liu and Shirley developed, called BioInspector. They actually try to incorporate third-order Markov model into the background model. But you have lots of problems with this alignment algorithm like this. The reason that the oligofrequency contrast algorithm is quite specific is that actually it doesn't assume any background model, right? It takes accounts from the whole genome as background. It does not make an assumption about what these strains are made of. It just simply counts everything in the genome. That's why it's pretty specific.
Which one does that?
The Helden Claude Vidas algorithm. Mm-hmm. The oligofrequency contrast algorithm. Because it does not make a model about the statistics of this strain, right? It just says, I want to compare the statistics of my strain in this 20 gene compared to the 6,000 gene in the genome. That's it.
But then you think at the very least they should look at the statistics of non-open frames.
Yeah, yeah, they actually look at non-open reading frame, yeah. And you can do various things, yeah. GIP sampler does the same thing. GIP sampler is basically just a finite temperature version of consensus, where you, instead of gradually descend to the local minimum, you try to move this sampling of paths around, right? It's just like we do finite temperature Monte Carlo, right? The Metropolis type of algorithm, where instead of... Oh, with two singular. Yeah, bioprospector allow you to do. Okay. I think I'm going to skip Moby Dick. We developed some algorithm that based on segmentation that looks for combination of motifs in a sequence. And I talked about that 2 years ago, and I'm not going to talk about this. So just for people who is interested in running this algorithm, the algorithm basically can identify the words in the scrambled text, and we use that for analyze the combinatorial motifs in promoter region. So I'm going to skip that. I think I'm going to just summarize and stop. It's almost 2 hours, and it was planned for 1 hour. Okay, so the basic summary, we just have an enormous amount of data. And it's many of this data systematic, right? Genome-wide, large-scale data. We have lots of sequences, DNA protein sequences, structures, lots of functional data. So I think we are overflowed by data now. And so with the emergence of this data, people spend lots of effort building various databases. And anything you can imagine, basically there is a database. That's amazing, right? Really. If you search, like you want to know the protein localization stuff, there's a database, and there's a tool to search for it. So there are lots of stuff like that, and then there are lots of analysis tools, right? So for every database, you want to do some analysis. People will develop some tool, some good, some bad, whatever. But there are tools there. And my perception or summary is that most of the bioinformatics tasks are so far are purely driven by known mechanisms, right? As I try to organize these topics around that genetic information flow diagram, people are trying to find genes, they try to infer functional proteins, they try to figure out the regulatory control side that's responsible for gene regulation. All these are pre-driven by our knowledge. The biologists say that, yeah, there's a gene, gene has this kind of structure, has promoters, introns, exons, and transcription controlled by transcription factor binding to binding site, et cetera. So it's all driven by known mechanism. That's why what the bioinformatics so far has been very useful, but still largely a service. Do you agree with me? I mean, it's mostly still largely a service. But what I see, the future challenge is really, given that we have this multiple source of data, the new bioinformatics direction should be able to utilize this data, take advantage of this data, and build interesting mechanistic models. The models that really say something about mechanism. And then you can basically, hopefully you can suggest new principle based on these mechanistic models. I think that's the exciting direction bioinformatics is going. I mean, the canonical definition for bioinformatics, according to people like Ross Altman, right, will be database storing, storage, archiving, huge amount of biological data, and develop tools to analyze them. I think that's probably a little narrowly defined. The emerging direction will be, I think, to really take advantage of huge amount of data, build mechanistic models, and make new predictions. So, okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.